Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Róisín Lanigan's brilliant new novel reinvents the haunted house genre for the age of forever renters. I want to go home, but I'm already there. It's also a very funny novel, by the way, and it's full of dry Belfast wit and withering put-downs of everyone from letting agents, yes, finally get their comeuppance, to house renovation influencers. Mm. Also, yes, well done, Róisín. Let's meet the woman behind the latest moment that Irish writers are having. We're having them all the time. Róisín Lanigan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations. Sure.
Thank you.
Your work is nearly done here, because by the time you've come in to talk to us, the reviews have absolutely gone wild for you, haven't they? That's nice. Now, a lot of listeners, and some of them already in touch this morning, have experience of the rental market. Some people don't. Mm. Can you shed some light, first of all, on what it's like in London in 2025?
Yeah, not great. I'd say that possibly not as bad as Dublin.
Yes.
It seems to be catching up. So one of the things I was just saying is in London, it wouldn't have been very common to have strangers renting out a bed in a room, which
right.
is now becoming more common. And, you know, in Dublin, it seems to have been around for a lot longer.
We've pioneered it.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you so much
well done, Dublin.
And yeah, there's more like bidding processes. I don't know if you get that in Dublin
That is happening. It's more to do with getting there on time and basically handing in a pound of your flesh and money and blood transfusion.
Exactly. Or like, I remember like, so about 6 months ago, I looked at this place and it was just at the very top of my budget. And then, so I went, oh, okay, well, I'll take it. And look, I'm so nice. And, you know, I'll live here for as long as you want. And then she came back and she was like, well, if someone else has offered £500 more.
£500?
Yeah. So I just had to give it up then. And that's becoming more and more common, that people sort of outbid each other.
I think about 3 years ago, I was hearing people paying roughly what they might in Dublin, 2,500 or something a month, and getting a very nice place in London compared to the horrible spot.
The difficult thing is, during the pandemic, I think a lot of people left London and left Dublin as well. Like, I mean, I did it as well. I moved back to Belfast. That was nice because it's, you know, cheaper, but comes with its own problems, and you kind of contribute to bringing the rental crisis elsewhere.
I see, right.
Because then you have people, and I wrote about this before, where people come from London or Dublin where cost of living is much higher. They're used to paying so much for their rent that they'll go to another city and then offer above and just say, well, I'll pay you £400 more than this person, so just give the house to me.
So ramps up the rent
exactly.
everywhere else.
So
then the capital will always go higher again.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the vicious cycle we're in. You've been talking a lot as a journalist, because you've done a lot of journalisting, about that imbalance that exists between landlords and tenants. And the landlord in this book is very evocatively described. Anonymous spectral gombeen sucking up all your capital.
Yeah.
So you're not a fan?
No, I'm not a fan of landlords. I guess I just don't think... I think that there's a strange tendency to think of our landlords as friends, which is a bit of a cope, because like there is a power imbalance there. And if you think of them as people, then that makes it easier to, you know, give them 70, 80% of your salary.
Yeah.
But they are still exploiting you by taking 70, 80% of your salary.
And they're spectral because there's a letting agent in between, so you rarely hear from them.
It's not even that. I think it's just like, so if you have experience of renting, the amount that you have to tell someone about yourself, and you often don't even know who you're telling, so you're giving this to an estate agent or to a landlord that you never meet, and you have to tell them, okay, so here's who I lived with, and here's where I lived before, and here's how much money I make, and here's my job, and you know next to nothing.
And are you in a relationship
people.
Or not?
Or do you things. Have any, you know, have you ever been convicted of anything? Like, do you have a pet? Like, it's you're kind of advertising yourself to someone. It's almost like having a dating profile, but the other person on the other end of the Hinge profile doesn't tell you anything. So it's very, it's an imbalance there, I think.
They don't have to tell. They don't get vetted out in
no,
the same way.
Exactly.
Now, in the housing crisis discussion here in Ireland, there's a lot of defence of landlords.
Mm.
Landlords who have their houses destroyed by tenants. They have people who don't pay their rent. And if someone doesn't pay their rent, it's quite difficult to get rid of them. So we do hear that end of things as well. And landlords are tortured in some ways. I suppose it's just people up against each other.
I have been told that that I need to be slightly fair to the landlords, but I think, well, my experience is in mainly in London or in Belfast, where it is actually quite easy to kick people out of your house, and there are relatively few. The Rental Reform Bill is trying to come in to change that, but there is a power imbalance, and I think that, you know, even when we talk about people's rents, people's flats or houses being destroyed, I think realistically it's often not their only property. So it must be difficult to have your flat destroyed, but it's awful nice if you have seven or eight more to rely on, perhaps.
Just one. Or they're just they're trying to pay their mortgage. Perhaps, this is another issue as well, isn't it? That it's tied to the mortgage so much, so sometimes an excuse for rent going up is my mortgage has become more expensive.
Yeah, and I think that that's become more common, that transparency. I would never have heard that more than maybe 3-4 years ago. And then I'd say like around the time of the pandemic, when mortgage rates changed and mortgage rates went up, that you had landlords saying to you like, oh, well, it's my mortgage, which is, again, understandable. But I do sort of bristle at me being the sole breadwinner for my landlord. So like, if I don't pay my rent, like, he can't pay his mortgage. That's not really a job, is it?
Well, you're in the house, they would say. Come here, what's your current living situation? Can I ask you?
I still rent.
In London.
Like, I'd love to say that this was so successful that I just bought seven or eight houses. But
It might be coming.
I still wouldn't be buying seven or eight houses.
So you basically are this lead character, Anya, aren't you, in some way? She's an Irish girl.
It's fictional. I've never lived in a haunted house, just bad ones.
Set the scene for us for the opening of this book and where Anya and her boyfriend finds herself.
So she begins the book living with her best friend Laura, that kind of part of your 20s or 30s where you're living with your friends. Her best friend decides to move in with her boyfriend and they get this houseboat that they're renovating, and so Anya has to move in with her boyfriend, and she has no reason not to because they're supposedly very in love. So they find this flat which is under asking price and in this lovely area, and she's immediately suspicious of this. And she spends the whole tenancy, so the book is sort of told over the course of their tenancy, thinking that something is very wrong, that there's something supernaturally wrong with the house, and Elliot's not so convinced. And it charts their relationship, the tension in their relationship, and also like with the landlord over the course of this year.
And what's going on in Anya's life that she's sort of feeling smothered by this house?
I think that she's just, it's kind of, someone described it recently as her Saturn return, which I think is like an interesting way of describing it. She's in this second adolescence where she feels she has to grow up, and the relationship isn't perfect and the house isn't perfect. And Anya is someone that thinks that these things should be perfect for her to, you know, put her whole weight behind them. And she, I think that there are a lot of like material problems in her life that she then transposes onto supernatural. But maybe there is a ghost, you know.
It's up
to people to decide.
I couldn't barely figure it out. I was halfway through and it's kind of going, I'm starting to lose my mind slightly as well. And your idea of the haunted house story, you were listening to kind of a podcast and you had a kind of a dawning, didn't you, what haunted houses stories are all about?
Well, I was listening to, I don't know if you've sort of aware of this like recontextualization of like Amityville, which is, you know, this hugely
famous
lucrative,
haunted house.
And people saying now that perhaps that wasn't a haunt and perhaps it was more to do with this family put all their investment into this huge house. And they were a Catholic family, so it was very difficult for them to get divorced and move away. They were tied to this house. And the fact that it was haunted allowed them to leave it and also freed them up financially to talk about that experience. And it made me think that like haunted house stories are just about finance, they're about owning property essentially and being tied to property.
Zombie capitalism.
Exactly, yeah.
Basically zombie. And that's the feeling that goes through it. But it also works as a ghost story as well. So you obviously you must love scary stories.
I do, yeah. I love like haunted house stories and like scary movies and stuff like that. And, you know, I watched The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. I love that.
Thought
that was brilliant. So I'm interested in that genre, but I wanted to like turn it on its head. There's some things that I don't like in horror. I don't like how women are depicted in horror, and I wanted Anya to be sort of a rebuke of those kinds of
women.
That's
got much better though, hasn't it?
It has got better, but I think particularly in haunted house, like even in things like Hereditary, which is like a modern haunting,
the
mother is still very, very put upon and martyred and ignored by her son and her husband and those kinds of things. So I think that women often occupy that space in a haunted house.
I suppose I was thinking about the Invisible Man. with Elizabeth Moss. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I really love that. That's incredible. That was great.
Yes, and it's got a kind of scary house in the beginning. Beautiful house.
Exactly.
But it's like, it's a prison. And good ending.
Much like this one.
Good ending. Yep. Jumping back, because there's people coming in, the landlords are complaining already, bad tenants and so on. You've had a rough time as a renter, though.
I've had a good time and a bad time as a renter, but I think that it's more the lack of choice that annoys me. And the fact that having a good time as a renter is still... it's still not on a level playing field. Like, I couldn't just decide to... I could never go to my landlord and be like, oh, you know, me and you have a good friendship here. Could you knock £400 off? I know you're not paying as much as I'm paying you. So I've had very nice landlords. I've had awful landlords. I think the ubiquity of the landlord is the thing that is annoying. Like, it's a hamster wheel. You can't escape it. My generation will always experience that. You can't get out of the housing crisis because no one is selling or buying their houses.
Yeah. And obviously you can't save because your rent, the most of it is going.
And that's what's frustrating as well, is you go to a mortgage advisor and they say, well, like, oh, you don't have enough savings and you don't earn enough to buy a house. But often your mortgage payments would be the same as your rent payments. And you know that because your landlord is telling you that.
But I suppose because the horror stories you've experienced have informed this novel, I mean, it's a damp flat they go into, and then of course they're accused of a letting agent of making the flat damp and giving instructions about lids
very common. I've definitely heard that, like, oh, it's because you don't put the lids on when you're cooking your pasta. It's just maddening. Like,
and I have also heard from landlords saying that tenants would block up the vents that make the house breathe.
Because it's cold.
Because there's a draft. Yeah. But also the draft is the thing keeping the house breathe.
Yes, yeah.
Two sides. Two how bad was it for you? Did you had bed bugs at one stage?
I had bed bugs when I first moved to London, within like the first week of moving there, and had to just throw out all my stuff, which is brilliant. And then moved to like a flat up the same street, and it was like an agency flat. I just sort of walked in off Bethnal Green High Street and gave someone, you know, a couple of £1,000, and they put me in this flat for the next year. I've had damp. I've had landlords. One landlord, her dad kept calling up the flat and saying, you know, she's really upset. She's crying all the time. It's
the banshee.
Just bizarre experiences where I was just like, well, I don't know what to tell you for that. And I've also had landlords who've been very, very nice. But they are still landlords at the end of the day.
You have it in. You have it in. You're not going to win them over, that's for sure. And in the story, we see the cracks developing in this relationship. So it has the kind of horror story element to it, and it also has this relationship thing. Is that very important now of the Gen Z millennial novel?
I think so. And I think that relationships don't break down on their own. And I think that, like, these precarious living situations do feed into that, and people moving in together quicker than perhaps they should, or staying together for longer. Or something that's common now is you have maybe like two or three or four couples living in the one house because it's like cheaper to you have a room each, and that puts pressure on relationships. So I do think the housing crisis has made millennial love and romance and Gen Z love and romance a very different experience to previous generations.
And you were getting married when you started writing the book?
I was getting married when I wrote the book, and I am now divorced. But it wasn't a ghost, it was just...
Just didn't work out. Because you're very young, and obviously that's a sad story itself.
It is, but I think that, like, that's, like, as I say, that millennial and Gen Z love and relationships and expectations of it has changed. I think that the rise in young divorces is a part of that. So I remember when I was getting divorced, seeing ads on the tube quite often for apps that you could use to help, like, to hire divorce lawyers.
Really?
And it was funny because they were aimed at, to me, divorce was like a thing that happened to older people, but these apps were like, help your son get through his divorce. So I think it was possibly the influx of post-pandemic breakups, and
I see.
Everything was much more like hingified in terms of
divorce. So you were married for just a year, wasn't it?
Yes, just a year.
Was it British law divorce, or was it quick to get divorced?
I think it was a year, that you could get divorced. And I think it's different here. 2 years?
Yes, you have to be living apart for at least 2 years before you can even begin the process.
I mean, that's...
Don't get into the expense.
Crazy.
Was it expensive, by the way? Is it
In the UK, you can have no fault divorces. So if you don't have like existing property or anything that you share, which I did not, it's fairly easy, and it's all done via HMRC. I mean, I say easy, it's, you know, like difficult experience, which is why I wrote about it. I wrote about it for The Fence, like did an essay on that, and kind of this idea of like cultural young divorces.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it would be very more difficult if you had to break up for a year and live separately and divide all your assets up, that kind of thing.
And how are you now with that?
Oh yeah, I'm grand now. Yeah.
Like more than grand, are you kind of doing, giving us a Belfast, I'm grand?
No, genuinely I'm grand. It's yeah, it's one of those experiences that like, I didn't expect that essay to sort of have the wherewithal that it did. I think I just wrote it, thought no one would read it, and then everyone read it.
It
I was
really
like, oh,
did.
Brilliant, yeah. Here we go.
I think it's unusual, particularly over here, because I think the average age for getting married in the first place is late 30s at this stage, 37.
Well, I think people do get married later because they, it's, I've said this as well, it's like people get married later and have children later because where are they going to put these children? Like, where are they going to live when they get married? They can't buy house.
Yeah, the pressures that are there.
Yeah.
The other type of breakup is, of course, when friendships end.
Yeah.
And there's one of these in this novel. It's another housing related horror, isn't it? Just it is that separation where someone suddenly can afford their house and the other can't.
Or even just decides that they've moved on from that part of their life. And I think that like Laura and Anya, the best friend that she sort of breaks up with, I think that that's like the love story of the book more than Anya and her boyfriend Elliot, because friendship breakups I think can be more devastating than relationship breakups, because when someone, you know, as you've just done, when someone has a relationship breakup, you go like, and you're well now and everything's good, but you don't ever do that when someone breaks up with
that's
a friend.
Right, you don't.
You just sort of go like, oh okay, well that's sad, and you just move on. And it can be as devastating. These are very intimate relationships and they define a part of your life. And to move on from that in quite a broken way is really devastating.
And there's no separation process. So sometimes it can be a very blunt guillotine.
Yeah.
It's done. Over.
Like, well, you know, when you break up with someone and, you know, if you've been with someone for a long time, you get custody of various friends. And that can be very sad as well. So I think it's like it plays into all those kinds of things. And with female relationships as well, sometimes you can have what Laura has, which is you replace the intimate relationships that you have through friendships with a partner. And that part of your life just sort of dies away, which is very sad, I think.
So Anya loses Laura and Laura goes off into a houseboat with her American fiancé.
Yeah, which is a weird thing that the houseboat phenomenon, I think it is like there was this chat a while ago that it was the way of like hacking the property market, because you could buy a houseboat for maybe like 30 grand and do it up, and then that could be your first house. And it's like, well, you still are living on a boat, like it's just so aware.
Surrounded by freezing water.
There's no Wi-Fi and you've got to move it every 2 weeks or something.
And doing it up, which is what Laura proceeds to do, and that's how she becomes the influencer.
Yes, she does.
You have a wry look at her. The London parties you frequent, what kind of things do you hear about the housing market? People obviously complaining about rent as well, but some of them, it turns out, have more comfortable backgrounds than...
It's quite a lot of like nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And I think that like that's something I didn't really anticipate when I first moved over there, because I just took everything as face value. So when everyone was going, oh yeah, my flat's awful too, I was like, oh, well, okay, well, so we're all the same. And then suddenly, much like Laura or in the book, it's like they would just disappear off into this much nicer flat, which it turns out would be like, you know, a family friend or... So I think... Because the housing crisis has this lack of transparency, because the British class system has a lack of transparency, everyone accesses housing in different ways.
Right.
And it makes it more difficult to have these conversations because people get very squeamish about it. Like, particularly with friends, it's difficult to say, well, you know, but your dad bought you a flat. You know, those are uncomfortable conversations, particularly in London, because I think English people are very bad at talking about money.
Yes.
They're not good whatsoever. So... I think
so it becomes awkward.
It becomes super awkward.
So you're hearing someone talking about, oh, it's terrible, the housing crisis.
Yeah.
And then it turns out they're not actually.
Yeah, yeah. They say it's terrible, the housing crisis, if they're talking about something that's happening in a very far away place, which I suppose in many cases it is for them.
They're Bridget Jones basically saying, isn't it awful about Chernobyl? Or
yeah, Chechnya. That's what I was just thinking, yeah.
And that's the Nepo housing market.
Yeah, it is.
There are loads of funny moments in this. You mentioned the bed bugs, which surely inspired your shopping around for mattresses.
Yeah.
Actually, I can't remember off the top of my head. Is it the names of the mattresses sound like mistresses or something?
They sound like... Well, I do find that when you go into... they're all named after like really... like this. They're like, this is the Dorothy. Would you like to sleep on the Dorothy?
I like
and you're kind of thinking, not really, no.
And of course, Anya, who works in a job online, is just scrolling mindlessly in her bad flat with the oppressive atmosphere. YouTubers crying about why they've stopped being YouTubers and so on.
Yeah.
And the ethically grown lab diamond that Alex. you have a lot of crack there at that generation that ticks that box. About yourself then, you're from Belfast, grew up there.
Yeah.
And where exactly in Belfast?
I'm from West Belfast, so I grew up just off Falls Road. And then, grew up there, moved to London. I went to Queens and then I moved to London right after I finished.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and so I've been back and forth between Belfast and London ever since then.
What's that like going over and back?
In some ways, it's nice. I mean, London is, for all, it sounds like I'm complaining about it because I'm like, it's so expensive and you can't buy a flat. Yeah. It's very fun. City, all these.
That's why you're there.
All these cities where you can't afford a house are very fun places to be.
Yeah.
And that's the great like catch 22 of it. But no, I love being there. I love being back home. So it's quite nice to be able to flip between.
You're only young in your 30s, but
yes.
you had a devastating diagnosis in your what age were you?
I was 26 when I found out I had breast cancer, and. So I stayed in London for that rather than coming home, and just because I thought like it's nice to have the normality, and I was working and I at that time was living with friends, and you know, you feel very young, that's quite a young age. I didn't want to come back home and quit my job and be looked after and be a burden on everyone, so it was how I felt about it at the time. So so I stayed and worked through. I had chemo and radiotherapy and everything else. And I think that possibly that's why I now work very, very fast. And I always need to be working. It kind of focuses my mind a wee bit.
Yeah, you kind of glossed over that.
Well, it's
incredible
also
time in your 20s. And the decision to stay in your rented accommodation in London, going through that, thinking about life and death, I presume, the whole way through.
What was really difficult about it was I remember someone saying to me at the time, well, like, you should definitely come out of work and you should get statutory sick pay. And I had never looked at that before. You know, I'd grown up like on various benefits like EMA and, you know, child tax credits and stuff like that. But I never experienced statutory sick pay. I looked into it. It was like pitiful. And I realised that to give up my job and do that, I would have had to leave London because I couldn't have afforded to live there.
The rent.
But also, like, you know, a lot of these private rental like accommodations, they don't like to have anyone that is on any kind of benefits, sick pay or DSS or HAPS, I believe it's called.
That's very good research.
So that was I would have lost, my life would have fallen apart. So it was like life or death, but also like, what are you coming back to if you
You couldn't have kept working though, you were getting chemo.
I did, yeah. So I took I took the day of chemo off, and it was like every 2 weeks, and then that week I worked from home, and then the next week I went back and I was in like a big open office, and I would like annoy everyone to use hand sanitizer and stuff because I had no immune system.
Yeah.
But I do think that
were you writing?
I worked at ID then, so I was
that's
doing
an offshoot from the Independent.
No, it's a fashion magazine, so it's owned.
Oh, sorry, yes.
It was owned by at the time by Vice, so I worked at Vice. And
very good.
They owned that, but
so features and things.
That kind of thing, and like social media type stuff at that time. But I really do think it kept me sane, and I know that that's a privilege to say that some people would have been a lot more sick and wouldn't have been able to make that choice.
That's Belfast grit for you. Keep going through that. So you decided, look, I want to be a novelist. I'm going to get this book. And you did it quickly then.
I did, yeah. Although I saw someone online saying like, oh, you can tell she wrote it quickly the other day. I was just like, So I'm going to stop saying that I wrote it quickly.
Don't focus on the bad reviews.
I haven't even found that book. It took me endless years.
And tell us about the tattoos, which are, I think they mark your treatment.
Yes, you can see. So I didn't realise all this cancer terminology that people have. So you get a scan every year to check whether you have any evidence of disease in your body. And then when you have 5 years of clear scans, people will say like, oh, you're cancer free. That's what some people say. So I got these palm tattoos when I got 5 years. So this one says, I love you. And this one says, I'm glad I exist, which is the final two lines of a nice poem by Wendy Cope that I really like.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. So it's very painful. But.
And you have a sunny disposition in life.
Well, yeah, you know.
We can tell.
I'm one of those annoying people that like, I've been through so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, use it. You know?
Exactly. Please buy the book.
There are messages coming in. Are they all about, had to move to London in the 80s, age 24. There's plenty of cheap housing in Ireland, but no jobs. Had to rent a room, work two jobs to get a place of my own, then rent out the rooms to pay the mortgage and defer having family. All young adults have to find their way and make choices. I'm tired of comparison saying my generation had it easy. Well, nobody's saying that in this conversation. No. But of course, in those days, you could save up enough to buy a house, but it's gone beyond.
Well, also squatters' rights were different back in the day. And now, you know, you can't really squat in a flat either.
This is what you're campaigning for
now. Well, no, I'm just, you have like property guardianship, but even that, it's not that much cheaper. So I'm not saying it's worse, but.
And like you're a successful writer and you're saying there's no hope of you owning your own house either here or in Britain or in Belfast.
No, I would say perhaps in Belfast, but even that is changing massively now.
It is, because I a year ago I was saying that we tend to go to Australia and Canada quicker than consider the north, even though it's far cheaper than the south.
Yeah.
But it is changing. People in.
But also just there's not a lot of infrastructure cross border. There needs to be more in order to like support.
Despite this lovely piece of fiction, which has got rave reviews from Oshie McKenna, who we had in here last year, and is a Drogheda lad writing amazing stuff in London. Seamus O'Reilly, another, he's Derry lad in London, all the writers over there. It sounds like you're going to do a lot of journalism still.
I am, yeah. I'm still working away. I actually work with Seamus. We both work at The Fence.
Is that right?
So we have like a cabal of all the lads over there. But no, I'm still writing. So I've got a piece coming out in the Sunday Times in a few weeks about snooker, which I'm very excited about, you know.
You wrote a famous piece about the Rose of Tralee for Financial
wrote
Times.
Wrote about the Rose of Tralee, my favourite.
The right place to be. Ugh. But in the meantime, everyone should go out and enjoy the novel. I Want to Go Home, But I'm Already There, basically. It's out now in shops and libraries, published by Penguin Random House. Roisin Lanigan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And
for
keep that fire that's in your belly. Keep it going, and we'll enjoy the fruits of that. Enjoy your day. Thanks,
Thank
man.
You. Back